99.5 WBAI.
You're listening to WBAI in New York. Stay tuned for Any Saturday with David Rothenberg.
Better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand,
give me five, Jimmy boy,
will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
You start off each day with a song.
Hit it!
Each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Now even when things go wrong,
Jimmy, you're a wild.
Why, you feel better. Let me hear those violins.
Let's hear the violins.
Music is, does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Only the other day I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go. You have to push it.
A million of them.
Now you know.
Yeah.
You just start off each day with a song. You gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh, with a song.
Now even when things go wrong.
Things go wrong.
Mr. Crosby, what? I can do without that echo. But bingo, I'm in great voice tonight.
You,
it reminds me
lovely.
Of the last recital I gave at Carnegie Hall.
Yeah?
It was delightful chamber music. And they came from miles around.
Who came?
Chambermaids. Who else? Hit that band, hit it. Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Not much.
Why, if you start off each day with a song.
Oh, there's more than one way to start off a day with a song. Thank you, Jimmy Durante. I think that was maybe Bing along with him. I'm David Rothenberg. The program is Any Saturday, and this listener sponsored WBAI 99.5 FM in the Apple, Big Apple, New York City. It's May 14th, and in about 8:40, we're going to have an interview that I taped a few days ago with Carolyn Wormus. I want you to stay. I hope you will stay tuned for it. I don't want you to. I hope you will. I'll talk about it a little later, but I'm excited about this interview. I heard it, one of the city doctors talking this week about the vaccine, and that many people are asking about the long-term effect of the vaccination. I think that, particularly with their children getting vaccinated, I think they should be asking about what are the long-term effects of the virus. Those of us who know that chicken pox, the long-term effect, you could get shingles. Long-term effect of smoking is you can get cancer. The long-term effect of drinking excessively is that you can get sclerosis of the liver. I find the question about the long-term effect of the vaccination a sidetracking of the real aspect that we have to, it's almost dilutes the fact that people have to get vaccinated so that we can finally get rid of this COVID, which has reshaped our society for the nearly 3 years. That being said, we're listener sponsored and I get theater tickets. So I want to get this to you early. I'm finally tomorrow going to the matinee to see the show that so many of you have been raving to me about. A new musical called Romeo and Bernadette. One listener wrote in and said that, emailed me and said he's been going to shows for 5 years through BAI and this is the best one. It's a musical about, I'll tell you more about it next week because I'm seeing it tomorrow, but I know the outline is that Romeo survives the potion, ends up in Brooklyn, rather contemporary, setting and falls in love with a girl named Bernadette. And that's the musical. It's called Romeo and Bernadette. We have tickets for BAI listeners. If you want to support us, you make a gift of $50 to WBAI. And we have tickets for this Wednesday matinee at 2 o'clock, Wednesday night at 7, and Thursday night at 7. If you are so inclined, if you want to share on New York's cultural richness and diversity, you email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com, and then I will call you over the weekend and arrange for you to get tickets. I'll get your credit card and all that information. So that's Romeo and Bernadette, Wednesday matinee, Wednesday night, and Thursday night. The evening performances are at 7. We also have tickets for Alice Childress's play, 1972 play Wedding Band, which got a rave in the New York Times this week. They said it's been 50 years since it's been revived, and startling as pertinent today as it was then. I saw it in 72 with Ruby Dee. It's about a young African-American woman in South Carolina in 1918 who falls in love with a white man. And the play is called Wedding Band. And part of the good news to that, it's at the stunning Pulaski Shakespeare Center in Brooklyn, one of the most beautiful edifices. What's the plural of edifice? Edifices that you'll ever see in New York or anywhere. What a stunning theater. Going there is just a treat. So we have tickets for Wedding Band also, Tuesday through Saturday night, including matinees on Saturday and Sunday. Wedding Band, Shakespeare Center in Brooklyn. Email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. So those are two shows you can see that helps keep us on the air. That's how it works. Your gifts to BAI, that's what listener-sponsored means, and it allows us the independence to yak the way we do. Let's have a little musical interlude. Johnny Hartman, one of my favorites. A very inviting ballad. And if Kathy presses the right button, Mr. Hartman will sing to us right now.
Hope my attitude won't bother you, but the day was long and my mood is blue. I couldn't think where else to go. I just dropped by to say hello. Nothing special that I want to say. I just came to pass the time of day. I've told my heart it mustn't show. I just dropped by to say hello. I've forgotten just how sweet our love was, except now and then. Memories fall just like the rain, and I remember when. Well, don't let me bore you anymore. I'm not quite as lonely as I was before. I didn't want the thing you know. I just dropped by
say hello. Quite as lonely as I was before. I didn't want a thing, you know. I just dropped by to say
that voice get you in the mood to start the day? Johnny Hartman, the wonderful Johnny Hartman. There was a page one story in the New York Times on Sunday about Ed Koch's furtive sex life, and I was mentioned in it frequently in the article, which prompted endless amount of emails and phone calls and stoppings on the street. I was impressed by that. On Saturday, midday, the emails began from people who were reading it online. And there seemed to be two responses to it, very varied responses. One is, why is it so important to Ed Koch, long dead? Who cares about what his sex life is? And the other, which was much more, I don't know if it was more thoughtful, but I got a lot of discussion and emails and phone calls from people who thought it was a very significant article, because and it revealed that Ed Koch's furtive or closeted homosexuality had a political impact, and that his resistance to responding to the AIDS crisis, which was identified with the at its beginning with gay men, that it inhibited his doing the responsible political thing, which was to provide funding and research and to alert other political people, as far as Washington, the Reagan administration, that this was a crisis. And eventually it became that. But I say Ed because I did know him before, as well as when I was in public, called him Mayor Koch, but It was vital that Ed Koch's sexual inhibitions or fears or political ambition had a impact on the political decision that he was making. And it shows the great damage of not only of him, but of anybody who has suppressed feelings and the impact that it has on unknown third parties. And when you're in a political leadership, it's quite important. It's even more significant. And certainly the coming out of gay men and gay women in public life has had a political as well as a personal impact. But then one can say that the personal always is political. I was in awe of the fact that the story was quite lengthy and everybody seemed to have read it all the way through. Sometimes the Times has those 2 and 3 and 4 page disclosures, like on Tucker Carlson, that they had the previous week. You know, after 3 paragraphs, you thought, I know enough about him to keep me busy for the rest of my life. I don't need it anymore. But the Ed Koch story seemed to have been read thoroughly. And dialogues were being created as a result of it. So that's my story on that. Tickets to the theater. I saw Americano this week. Many of you have seen it. What a voluptuous, inspiring tale of a young man, a dreamer, a Mexican born who came to America when he was 2. His family did not tell him he was Tony did not know that he was an American citizen, was denied entrance into the Marines, which was his dream, because they said, you're not a citizen. And he became an activist. And these music people wrote a musical about him. And the voices and the songs are inspiring. I recommend it to you highly. We do have tickets. You can support BAI. You can go this week, Monday, Wednesday, Thursday at 7, Friday at 8, Saturday and Sunday at 2, Saturday night at 8. $50 for a pair of tickets to see Americano, part of our music theater cavalcade that keeps us going and keeps you being part of the city back in the post-pandemic area. I don't know if we're post-pandemic, but people are just going out doing it. The theaters are packed. Even the movie theaters are filled. And so I hope you take advantage of this offer to see Americano. And then at the Joyce Theater, we have a three pair for Tuesday night for the opening of the world premiere collab, Stephen Petronio's company, world premiere in collaboration with the Monster Black Leads Mixed Bill, Calling for Connection and Hope, which features the Young People's Chorus of New York City. It sounds like a theater evening made for the BAI audience, doesn't it? Socially conscious and artistically excellent, because if it's at the Joyce, you know that the voices and the dances will be wonderful, because that the joy is the epitome of dance excellence in our country, in our city. And it's right here for you to take advantage of. And do you ever get there? I go to the Joyce a half a dozen times a year. I don't care what's playing. If I have a free Wednesday night, let's go to the Joyce, because you'll see some dancing excellence. Tuesday night, three pair, 7:30 curtain. Email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com, and you can go to the Joyce. So we have four things for you to see now this week. Romeo and Bernadette, a new musical off Broadway. It opens Monday night. The reviews will come out. There's already talk that it might be moving to Broadway. That good. I will see it tomorrow. I'll let you know the real story next week. Alice Childress's wedding band at the Polanski Center all this week. Matinees, by the way, abounding for the people of a certain age prefer. But, you know, with these 7 o'clock curtains, by the time you get out, it's still light. Americano at the New World Stages and at the Joyce, the Stephen Petronio Company. So there's a lot for you to enjoy. Let's have some music. Jill O'Hara does this beautiful song by Joni Mitchell. Then I'll do Out on a Limb, and we'll get ready to hear the interview that I did a few days ago that it taped. In the meantime, Jill O'Hara. And the song is called River, and it was written by Joni Mitchell.
It's coming on Christmas, they're cutting down trees. It's coming on Christmas, they're cutting down trees. They're putting up reindeer and they're singing songs of joy. In peace, oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. But it don't snow here, you know, and it stays pretty green. I'm gonna make a lot of money, then I'm gonna quit this crazy scene. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away. Shine. loved me so naughty, he made me weak in the knees. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I'm so hard to handle, I'm selfish and I'm sad. Now I've gone and lost the best baby I
O'Hara River. Three stories caught my attention quickly. Mike Pence is backing Brian Kemp for governor in Georgia. That's incomplete. Brian Kemp is the governor that defied Trump, and Trump has put up a slate of people to defeat Kemp in the Republican primary, and Mike Pence has defied the master. Interesting little political development that be. There was several stories this week about a great increase in OD overdose of on drugs. And you may recall several weeks ago, our old friend Sam Rivera was on, who's the CEO of a two harm reduction centers, one in East Harlem, one in Washington Heights, and both have shown a dramatic reduction in OD overdoses. Addicts who are not overdosing, because there are centers that they can go to with safe needles and treatment and response. And I've visited them, and you can see that it's an atmosphere that permits people who are using drugs to sustain themselves. And that it's very controversial. No more so than bars that keep alcoholics busy, I've always said. But there's a bill in Albany to expand the harm reduction centers because it would save lives, the lives of drug users. And there is that slippery side of people that, why go to the trouble of saving addicts? Sam, on an interview recently on New York One, indicated how it saves the money that it would save to open these centers. But more than anything else, I want to know, where are the pro-life people on this issue? Why are they not coming forward saying we must have harm reduction centers to lessen the possibility of people dying from the fentanyl, which is that what it is? The drug that seems to be getting into everything that is being attributed to the increase of drug ODs. The pro-life people Where are they? That's the simple question that I want to ask. Third thing I want to draw attention to is that there's something called the Board of Correction New York. It oversees and it acts as an ombudsman to some of the whatever the mishigas is that's going on Rikers Island and the different county jails. Well, if the fourth inmate died this year, and we found out that there was a new member of the Board of Correction, I didn't know about him, appointed by Eric Adams, and he's a former correction officer. An unlikely choice for the Board of Correction to have a former correction officer be a overseeing the intricacies and the possible abuses that are taking place. But he emerged because after the fourth death on Rikers Island, he made a statement that said, "I personally feel that the four were natural deaths in this last 3 months. But there's no negative publicity about the 16 suicides that were committed last year." Well, that may be a valid position, Joseph Ramos, but that's not the role of the Board of Correction. The Board of Correction should be finding why four men, most people in their 20s, and the suicides, why they're taking place. That's the role of the Board of Correction, to oversee, to act as a supervisor, to hold the Department of Correction accountable. It's a terrible choice by Eric Adams, a terrible appointment and a stupid comment. And appropriately, a Board of Correction fellow board member, Dr. Robert Cohn, expressed his great displeasure with a fellow board member making a comment like that. Let's play Rodriguez, and I'll do out on a, no, let me, I'll do out on a limb right now, and then we'll play Rodriguez, and then we'll introduce the interview that I did earlier. My head has been spinning since the Alito leak, even though we knew that the Supreme Court edict was inevitable with the current court. It reminded me of the power of pragmatic politics. Going back to the presidential election of 2016, some of my friends on the left argued that there was little difference between Hillary and Trump, a slightly flawed feminist and a fascist. Hillary's most evident campaign drawback was that she had been in the public eye for nearly 40 years, and we knew where she stood on everything and only agreed with her at about 75% of the time. Trump's public record included full-page ads calling for the death penalty of the eventually vindicated Central Park Five, ads that ran before the trial. We also learned and then saw his obscene video revealing his autocratic vulgarity. He's a pig and a fascist. And many of us hollered, "The courts, the courts." If you find nothing that separates Hillary and Trump, consider who will be appointed to the federal courts. And here we are. And I'll let you in on a little secret. It's no fun being right. You may recall Mitch McConnell blocking President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. The Kentucky senator argued that it should wait until after the election so that the people's choice could decide, ignoring the reality that the people had elected Obama twice. So as we feared, Roe versus Wade will be overthrown. 20 states are already moving to make abortion illegal. And what else? What do we know? Well, the one thing that we do know is that women and girls unknown to us now will die making desperate and illegal efforts to abort, uninformed of alternative paths. If you're pro-life, you might be interested in that prospect, if you know anything about the history of pre-Roe versus Wade abortion history. We can also predict that the federal court's likely 5-4 vote will embolden political Philistines to venture into other areas, to turn back not just the clock, but the calendar. Governor Abbott in Texas has announced focusing on a 1982 law holding states responsible for the compulsory education of immigrant children. Here's a state ruler who wants to punish abortionists, but deny children brought into the world, the right to be educated, to give them greater opportunities to prosper. He wants to block hope. We can make a list of potential targets for the fascist politics whirling around us. Immigration laws, including the children's education, gay marriage is on the list. Eric Adams appointed an advisor to his administration who traveled to Uganda testifying in support of a law to imprison persons who commit a homosexual act. That's not comforting. Affirmative action, interracial marriage, voting restrictions, anything and all that would marginalize those already marginalized. Trump's campaign slogan, Make America Great Again, no longer has to be coded. They can just say it. American-born, white, male, heterosexual, and privileged. All else need not apply. If you want to go back to early America to be an originalist like Scalia, you may want to add on to that only property owners, male, white, heterosexual property owners. That's theory if you really want to be an originalist. Let's not lose sight of the immediate implications of a Roe versus Wade decision, which will increase by hundreds of thousands unwanted children being brought into our society. Today, one out of six American children go to bed hungry. Have you talked with any adults reflecting on their childhood of hunger, where stealing food for survival was the first of escalating antisocial acts, which caused resentment and often rage and evolved into antisocial act and criminal activity? I was a depression baby. We doubled up with relatives. That's what you did in those days. Years later, I asked my mother if we were poor, and she responded, well, were you ever hungry? That was the dividing line for many families during the Depression. I still can't look at spaghetti in the face, but I never experienced hunger. But that's not so with many of the men and women I met at Fortune Society over the years. Roe versus Wade was responsible for the decrease of hungry, alienated youth and a reduction in crime prior to Rockefeller's drug laws, when we began to incarcerate the addicted rather than treating them, particularly if they were black, brown, or poor white, a race and a class war. There was never a war on drugs, just a war on drug addicts. Roe versus Wade can lead us into a slippery slope of antisocial actions. We will be entering a new era, a war on children as the unwanted struggle. If you listen closely to the most insistent anti-choice voices, there is a sound of disapproval and a fear of human sexuality. Many have linked chastity to God, which would suggest that those who procreate have some explaining to do. Fascism rises in a field of ignorance, and that field is flourishing in America today. Let's get to work. I'm David Rothenberg, Out on a Limb. Here's Rodriguez. And then I will introduce our interview for the week. Rodriguez, if you will.
Was it a huntsman or a player that made you pay the cost, that now assumes relaxed positions and prostitutes your loss? Were you tortured by your own thirst in those pleasures that you seek, that made you Tom the Curious, that makes you James the Weak? And you claim you got something going, something you call unique. But I've seen your self-pity showing as the tears roll down your cheeks. Soon you know I'll leave you, and I'll never look behind, 'cause I was born for the purpose that crucifies your mind. So convince your mirror, as you've always done before, giving substance to shadows, giving substance evermore. And you assume you got something to offer, secret shiny in you, but how much of you is repetition that you didn't whisper to him too?
Rodriguez. I want to remind you that we have tickets for two musicals, Romeo and Bernadette. I'm seeing it tomorrow. I'll give a review next week, but everyone's telling me that I'm going to have a great time. We have tickets for Wednesday matinee, Wednesday night, and Thursday night. It's at Theater 555 on West 42nd Street, $50, and you support listener-sponsored BAI, and you get to the theater. Americano, the musical I did see last Sunday, it's almost operetta. It's a celebration of life about a dreamer, a man who's wants to be a citizen and is a citizen, just doesn't have the papers. It's a musical dream. It's at the New World Stages, and we have tickets all this week. Evening performances, including Saturday and Sunday matinee, $50 per pair. At the Polanski Center at Shakespeare Center in Brooklyn, Alice Childress's wedding band, all this week, including matinees on Saturday and Sunday and all the evenings. Got a rave in the Times this week if you want to Google it. And at the Joyce Theater Tuesday night, the opening of Stephen Perrarino's Company with the Young People's Chorus. Now, I want to introduce interview that was taped. I usually don't do this, but it was important for us. I met Carolyn Wallace when she got out of prison after doing 27 years. Her case was headlines. I remember the headlines. I never read the stories. And it was called the Fatal Attraction case, because the case came forward in Westchester shortly after the Glenn Close, Michael Douglas movie, which was so sensational. And in this case, Carolyn was accused and convicted of killing the woman who was married to a man. She was having a relationship with a school teacher, and his wife was killed. Carol has always maintained her innocence, and this is a discussion with her and her two lawyers. And one of her lawyers, Jeff Deskovic, has a story unto himself, which you will be about to hear. So, Kathy, let's hear the interview with Carolyn Wallace and her lawyers. I'm joined in the studio with Carolyn Wallace, Jess Deskovic, and Dennis Kelly. We're going to be talking about Carolyn's case. Carolyn Wallace was a headliner in criminal justice in the 1990s. The case was, the tabloids called it the Fatal Attraction case, because it took place 2 years after the movie that was a sensation. Carolyn was, it was a 1989 murder of Betty Jane Solomon, who was the wife of a man named Paul Solomon, a colleague of Carolyn's, where they were both teaching. She was tried and a hung jury in 1991, convicted in 1992, and was sentenced to prison and did 27 years before she came out 3 years ago. And in recent years, since her release, while incarcerated, Carolyn was fighting for her life and her innocence. And more recently, since home, a Westchester judge approved of DNA testing. I'm going to be talking about that. Jeff Deskovic
interestingly enough, also in Westchester, was convicted of a crime which he maintained innocence. And the Innocence Project, after his serving 16 years in prison, he was released, sued the state of New York, or Westchester County, received $41 million, and with that went to college and to law school. And as a lawyer, he's been working as a defender of people who have been falsely accused, and that's his symbiotic link to Carolyn. And Daniel Kelly, who is an attorney, a criminal defense attorney with Kelly, Grossman, and Kerrigan, is a second attorney working with Jeff for Carolyn's defense. So we're going to begin by talking with Carolyn. Who are you? Where did you grow up? What were your dreams as a child? This was not an anticipated journey in your life. So you started where? And I know it was Michigan.
Yes. Well, David, first I just want to thank you for having us here. It's such a blessing to be here and be able to speak openly and everything and not have, you know, my answers edited and changed around and everything. So I really appreciate this opportunity. Yes, I was from a small community in Michigan, suburbs of Detroit.
And you went to high school there, grammar school, high school?
Oh,
who were your folks? What were your dreams as a high school kid?
Yeah, went to public school my whole life, and then went to college at the University of Michigan, and was debating between becoming a teacher or a doctor, actually thinking about being a neurosurgeon, which was going to take many, 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 many years.
Yeah. And your folks, your mother and father, were, what kind of work did your dad do, your mother?
Well, outside of Detroit, a lot of people were in the automobile industry, so my dad sold insurance to automobile dealerships. So he was sort of affiliated with the automobile industry, and my mom was a school teacher, but then, you know, she retired and was a homemaker and a mom and, you know, raised us kids.
And you had siblings?
A brother and a sister.
And they're where now?
No one's in Michigan anymore. Everyone's moved out. They're all in different parts of the United States.
What are they
now.
Doing? What's your brother doing, your sister doing?
Oh, they're both in business, actually.
And you're in touch? You're close?
We're in touch, yes.
The reason I ask is when you went through this ordeal, were they a part of your life? Did you maintain a relationship with your family?
Oh, yes. Oh, I was very close to my family and very close to my parents. And I would, you know, it was such a horrible situation. I tried to keep them, you know, as far away from the media as I possibly could. But the other thing is that, you know, when the trials began to start, there were two trials, and before I was ever convicted, it took 3 years. My father, my stepmother, and my mother were all listed as witnesses for the defense. So when somebody's on a witness list, you are not allowed to be in the courtroom at all, whether you're on a prosecution's witness list or a defense witness list. So that was why my family was not there in court with me.
But you had a relationship with them outside of the court.
Oh, absolutely. We were on the phone all the time, and I would go and visit them and everything, so I saw them quite
a bit. Did the media interfere with their lives? Did they come after them? Because it was called Fatal Attraction, using the movie title, I didn't know the details of the case till I met you, but I remember the headlines because I had seen the movie. So I assume that everybody around you was touched in some way.
My entire family was absolutely touched. They were all harassed and followed and everything, but it really affected my father's business. Nobody wanted to do business with him after that. He ended up losing his entire business.
Really?
He lost everything. And it was all because of me in this case.
And what does he do? Is he still alive? Your dad's alive?
Both my mother and my father passed away while I was in prison.
Of course.
And I was not able to go to the funeral or have bedside visits or anything because I was in prison.
So you went to Bedford in 1992, maintained your innocence. How did going to prison is an ordeal when convicted and you know you're guilty. When you're maintaining your innocence, it has another dimension to it. How did you do your time? How did you get through? How did you maintain your sanity? And did you become a jailhouse lawyer immediately in behalf of yourself?
Yeah, I had always maintained my innocence. Before I went to prison, I had already taken a couple law classes at Columbia Law School. Then during the first trial, my attorney suggested I go and get my paralegal certificate, so I was doing that, so I had that. And then in prison, absolutely. I mean, I took the prison's law library classes, and then I worked in the law library as well. So I was definitely focusing on, you know, I've always maintained my innocence, but I was definitely focusing on trying to get out of prison.
While you were there, I would assume that you wrote to a million different people. Did you get response, for example, from the Innocence Project?
I wrote to so many different organizations, and I did get some responses. I did get a response from the Innocence Project telling me, you know, if I had an attorney, they would work with my attorney. So, I was trying to get an attorney at this point because now I was already convicted. But then I wrote to Jeffrey Deskovic's organization. He's got the Deskovic Foundation for Justice, which is wonderful because his foundation that he established focuses not only on DNA, but mostly on non-DNA issues. So in my case, you know, it was completely circumstantial, my case. The conviction occurred way before there was anything with DNA, before the existence of DNA, before there was ever CSI. You know, we see the TV shows and stuff, but none of that existed at the time.
When did DNA come in to being a factor in cases?
I mean, I was already in prison when, you know, we would watch the O.J. Simpson case on TV, and I was already in prison at that point.
So the DNA was established after you came out. You found out that there was DNA, or I don't know how that works. Maybe Jeffrey can explain that. Jeffrey Deskovic, who, as I said, went to prison for a crime he didn't commit in the same county of Westchester, did 17 years?
I did 16 years. And to clarify, there was a jury verdict of $41 million, but that's not that. I wish I got $41 million. There was actually an agreement in place that, you know, the county wanted an assurance that they wouldn't have to pay over a certain amount. And I gave them that assurance in exchange for a floor. So I didn't get 41. But moving on to the main point, DNA first came out in 1987, 88, you know, but it wasn't like something that was like widespread, commonly used. And, you know, it certainly didn't exist at the time, but, you know, Carolyn was arrested or, you know, for it was still just in its infancy at that point. It really wasn't something that was done on a widespread basis.
How did DNA affect your case, and what did you learn from that that can be transferred to Carolyn's situation?
I guess a simplistic answer is I was proven innocent through DNA testing. I mean, the DNA didn't match me before the trial. I was convicted anyway, based on prosecutorial misconduct, fraud, but coerced false confession, and a fraud by the medical examiner, which I want to come back to later, because that same villain in my case played a big factor in, you know, Carolyn being wrongfully convicted. But to get to the DNA answer, that when the DNA data bank was created, we took that crime scene DNA evidence and put it in a data bank, and it identified the actual perpetrator. And so I was exonerated. All charges against me were dismissed on actual innocence grounds, and the actual perpetrator was arrested and convicted of the crime based on that DNA. I'm only home because of DNA. My case demonstrates how innocence can be established.
Jeff, on that subject, I'm an innocent, and I guess I reflect a lot of people's thought. We read about DNA, and many people have seen CSI, and it's all the technical stuff that I don't understand. What, in both in your case and Carolyn's case, maybe you can describe what the DNA was in yours and what we are locating in Carolyn's case.
Yeah, the DNA in my case was seminal fluid. Okay, and that in Carolyn's case, there's seminal fluid. That's one of three items that's also going to be tested. And you know, we're also there's a glove. So you know, that's the prosecution's theory. The actual perpetrator wore the glove. So if they would have sweated into the glove, I mean, that's certainly something that could be subjected to DNA testing. And you know, and then there's the purse. So we look at DNA as having the potential to, you know, conclusively demonstrate, you know, Carolyn's innocence. There's many other pieces of evidence. Our whole case is not going to be based on that, but certainly, you know, that could be a grand slam in and of itself.
I'm wondering, why is this not out there? Do they suppress DNA information? Is there reasons for it? That it seems so obvious that if we now know that there is DNA and someone's maintaining innocence, why is that not front and center?
Well, not every district attorney's office wants to get to the truth or get to the bottom line. You know, myself and co-counsel, you know, Dennis Kelly, we represent Carolyn. But prior to our entering her case, she was trying to get DNA testing before that. And, you know, the district attorney, Westchester district attorney at the time, would not allow her to get the testing, and she filed a motion in court seeking to get that DNA testing, and again the prosecution fought, and the court unfortunately sided with the district attorney.
Carolyn, were you in prison when you were first asking for DNA?
Yes. Well, what they told us when I was during the trials is, first of all, the glove in my case, like this mysterious glove, appeared 3 years after the crime. And it had fresh blood on it. So the judge in my case ruled that the blood had been planted on the glove had been tampered with. But the prosecutor, the district attorney, said that, you know, there was not even enough blood on the glove. Now again, this was in 1992. The crime was in 1989. The district attorney said there was not even enough blood on it to be tested to find out what blood type it was, let alone anything further. Now, so many advances have occurred now, about this as well, that, you know, now they can do very small amounts of blood and old, degraded samples, and they can test it and get results now.
I was ready to jump when you said that, Dennis Kelly. Maybe you can explain, because when I watch these television fictional programs, and they, you know, they seem to get a tear drop, and they convict people on it. So when she said that there wasn't sufficient blood on the, I can't understand that. So
thank
you for joining us, Dennis.
Thank you, David. Initially, we have to talk about how this glove actually got into evidence. And in the first trial, there was no glove.
And whose glove was it?
We don't know whose glove it is. And this is a big mystery, and it's really inconceivable that the glove was actually introduced into evidence. Because what happened is, at the crime scene, a forensic person comes to the crime scene, and they see a glove that was discovered underneath the body of Betty Jean. And it was a leather glove. A leather glove. The initial police officer on the scene said, "I found this leather glove."
Can you tell if it's a man's glove or a woman's glove?
Well, at that point, no. Because it was just said it was... And we have to emphasize leather. That initial person said it was a leather glove. So the forensic person comes in and puts a chemical reagent to determine whether or not there's any blood on this leather glove. And that came back negative. There was no blood on the leather glove. They discarded it. For some reason, they felt that it wasn't...
Who is they?
The police. This was a bungled investigation from the get-go with regard to what happened initially at the scene. They did not preserve the scene. They did not preserve, for example, they let Solomon, who called 911 to discover his wife bleeding on his floor, he's got blood all over his hands. They allow him to go and wash his hands prior to them being able to come and do a test for gunpowder. So we believe that from the initial investigation, the whole investigation was bungled. But getting back to the glove, is so now we have this glove, this leather glove that was found underneath the body by a police officer, and it was discarded. Basically, after the forensic person realized that there was no blood on it, they basically
when
just
you say
left
discarded,
it.
It doesn't exist anymore?
Well, here's the rub, and this is where we get to this whole incredible introduction of a piece of key evidence that we have really no indication that it was the actual glove that was found that day. Because, again, we have in the first trial, no glove. And the district attorney said they asked Paul Solomon to scour his apartment to see if there's any type
Paul,
of...
Let's clarify. That's, Paul Solomon that is was the husband
the of husband the of Betty Jean,
and the
victim.
And the first trial was a hung jury.
Correct. And there was no glove at the first trial. And so the DA then said to Paul Solomon, see if you can find this glove. And while the second trial had begun, it was in the middle of the second trial, he then re-examines a glove box that was in his bedroom closet. And lo and behold, he finds a cloth glove, one cloth glove, that seemed to be a long lady's glove. This was not the same glove that was found at the scene. Mm-hmm. And if you go back and you see the evidence to admit this glove, Paul Solomon's asked, is this the glove that you saw at the scene? And he specifically said, I can't say that it is, and I can't say that it isn't. So then just finally, now that glove had blood on it. That we know the glove at the scene had no blood on it because it was tested for blood. And the irony of this whole, whether or not the district attorney would allow this blood to be tested, was their argument was, if we test this blood, we're going to use it all up. And there'll be no other, evidence after that. I don't know what they thought they were saving it for. So in any event, we now have this blood on the glove. And Judge Carey in the second trial said, the glove can go in, but not the blood. Now, Carolyn's defense attorney made a decision to say, I'm going to point out that there's blood there to raise a reasonable doubt. So it really was, trial by ambush at that point, because now they have the glove with the blood, but they don't want to test it. As a matter of fact, I believe at one point they said they were going to go test it during the second trial.
When you say testing, it's for
DNA. The DA, or the blood evidence,
yes,
to determine what type of blood it was, and the DNA. At that point, I don't know if they even had, they had rudimentary DNA back then, but I don't believe that they were even able to come up with a DNA profile at that time.
Explain what DNA is exactly, though.
Jeff, you want to take that one?
Is it a section of the blood? How do they
figure? Well, there's markers referred to as alleles, and they have to have a certain number that match in order to, and it's considered to be like the gold standard of evidence.
But what is it? It's in the blood. But what is it in the blood
DNA is a building block of genetic material, that it's in every cell that we have, that
That's
each individual has. And that cell can be transferred to other surfaces through sweat or bodily fluid or even skin cells.
And
as well as hair, semen, and everything.
And all of that. Now, mine, my DNA, no other person in the world can.
Right.
That.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's unique except for biological twins. So when it's so assuming that there's been no contamination, you know, DNA results are pretty much unassailable. So it's it's considered to be the gold standard of evidence. You know, a couple of quick points just that I wanted to make and throw additional light on the points Dennis made was, you know, Paul Solomon not only was the victim's husband, but he was an alternative suspect. He was the first person that the police suspected was involved. They never really had a reason why they shifted the focus from him onto Carolyn. You know, they came up with the story that Carolyn went to see Paul in Puerto Rico when Paul had invited Carolyn over there, but then he called the police and claimed that Carolyn was stalking him. And that was why they shifted the focus from him to Carolyn. But, you know, they never actually ruled him out through some investigation to come up with another piece of evidence. So that was one thing I wanted to point out. And the other thing is that he only testified under immunity. So God forbid your spouse is killed. You know, you need immunity to come and testify at the trial of the person that's alleged committed the crime.
Is he still around?
What's that? He's still around.
Forgive my naivete on DNA, and also on this, Dennis. You had said that the Bungle case, and in Jeffrey, in your case, it was more than bungled; it was conspiratorial. The question it's kind of chilling to think about it. Is it the cover-up because the reputation of the prosecution is more important than discovering the truth?
We see that all the time. We see that all the time in the wrongful conviction cases that Jeff and I collaborate on. We see that the district attorney's office many times they don't want to admit that either they themselves made the mistake or their predecessors made the mistake, committed.
And then there's that cop that the Brooklyn cop or New York.
Yes, Scarcella. Yes, Scarcella.
In your case, Jeff, you were literally tortured into a confession.
Yeah, they forced a false confession out of me, through threats and false promises. Yes, it's true. But the other thing, though, is there was also forensic misconduct. So this medical examiner, Dr. Rowe, you know, he altered, once the DNA didn't match me, he altered his theory to better fit the prosecution evidence. So he admitted that under oath in a deposition. And the interesting thing, and this is a huge reason why the foundation even came to, you know, accept Carolyn's case and, you know, believe in her innocence and, you know, be involved in this work of trying to exonerate her, is that he was involved in her case. He initially, Dr. Lewis Rowe, the Westchester medical examiner, he initially estimated time of death from 2 to 6, and then once he learned that Carolyn had an alibi for that time span and that she was with Paul Solomon, he then switched the estimated time of death to 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. And Carolyn, all that information, as far as Dr. Rowe's fraud in my case and in other cases where he, you know, where he altered his theory. My civil rights lawyers found 3 other cases where he altered his theory to fit the prosecution theory. Carolyn's defense lawyers never knew that. They weren't able to challenge his credibility on it. Dr. Rowe was complained of in neighboring counties where he was moonlighting as a defense expert, given false testimony in that way. So whichever way the money flowed, that was where his orientation was. You know, and so that's another important aspect of this.
Jeff, you were in prison when Carolyn's case was a headline. Were you aware of it, and did you identify with a lot of things?
Absolutely.
You're in the same county, a lot of the same people. I must add this.
Yes.
It's not relevant specifically, but I was fascinated when in talking with you at one point, you told me that in part of the prosecution, Jeanine Pirro was one of the prosecutors who is now the celebrated monster on Fox television. I just had to get that in.
Well, I'm glad that you did because, you know, she likes to claim she wasn't involved in my case, that she wasn't the DA when I was convicted. All right, true enough, but you took office before my first appeal was decided. You fought all the appeals. You blocked me from getting DNA testing. But I guess there's no moral culpability. But, you know, that's another villain that, you know, common to Carolyn's case and mine, you know, Jeanine Pirro, you know, was also the DA at the time of the second trial of Carolyn. And I was aware of her case when she went to trial the first time because we were going to court at the same time. So and I used to follow the newspapers. So I remember that. And certainly during her second trial, I was in prison. So I was following along that way.
What's going on in your head while all of this is going on? I mean, here you are, a school teacher, and you're a headline. And I've looked at, you know, since we met, I looked at all the old clippings, and it's all about the, you know, it's romance and it's love and it's all of that. And you're a very attractive young woman, which made for headlines. But you're a person and you're going through this ordeal. How did you sustain yourself? I mean, you're a smart, vibrant, active woman now. How did you sustain that? Where did you find the strength?
Well, I mean, during the trials, I was out on bail. So I was out on bail for 3 years. So I certainly had friends in Manhattan. So I was with friends, and I would also, you know, go see my family or get out of Manhattan on the weekends or do things like that, because the media was crazy. They were insane. I mean, they were staking out my apartment. I mean, this was the time, I don't know if you or your listeners, you know, recall back in the, you know, early 1990s when we had shows like Hard Copy and A Current Affair and Inside Edition, and they would do what they called reenactments.
Yes. Well, they're still doing that.
Oh, okay. Well, so they would have somebody who would look like me, and they would have somebody who looked like Paul Solomon, and they would have somebody who looked like the victim, and they would reenact something and have me be the murderer. And this is while I'm on trial, and all the jurors are watching this.
How do you pick a jury in something like this?
Well, it becomes kind of impossible. Now, by law, the jury is not supposed to have seen, read, heard about the case. But, you know, you're kind of naive to believe that, you know, that they're always truthful about that. You know, that brings me to another point about Carolyn's case is, you know, one of the other commonalities in wrongful conviction cases is prejudicial pretrial media attention. And, you know, in some ways, Carolyn's case is kind of like the penultimate example of that. So I believe that she never enjoyed the presumption of innocence. But another aspect, which I'll ask Dennis to elaborate on, you know, there's also a junk science aspect to this case involving Dr. Rowe in ballistics.
What is junk science?
Well, junk science is, so it's evidence that used to be allowed in the courtroom that sounds scientific, but it's actually not. Things like tire tracks, footprints, bite marks. It sounds scientific, but it's not, because there are no underlying studies. You can't say, well, how many vehicles actually could have left these tire tracks? Or, well, it's a size 9 boot and David has size 9. Well, yeah, David does, and how many other thousands, if not millions, of people do? So that's what junk science means. But in terms of the specific application here in this case, I'll throw the ball to Dennis to elaborate here.
And may I just interject that, you know, David, you know, you and your listeners are getting like an exclusive right now. I mean, this is the first time, I think, publicly with the media, that all of this new evidence that to prove my innocence
is being discussed.
So just so you know, thank you.
Well, Jeff was talking about, when we talk about junk science, one of the things that that we have pursued, although unfortunately the expert that we had passed away, with regard to the bullets and the forensics with regard to the rifling of the bullets going through a silencer. And that type of evidence has been really debunked since the time that it was testified to in Carolyn's trial, and it really has shown. And basically, what the science is, or alleged science was back then, is that each bullet going through a gun and/or a silencer chamber would have certain rifling on the sides of it that they could then compare to each bullet to say that they were shot from the same gun, or shot from a gun that was not recovered even, that said it was shot through a silencer. That type of science has, and that that discipline has changed very very significantly.
The science has caught up with the courts.
Correct.
So
correct.
What is your plan now? You have this new approach or the new sciences, but you have to go into an old court. When do you go in, and how do you go about that?
Well,
and where do you go?
The reason that we're able to get the DNA tested now is Carolyn wrote what's called a 440 motion, and she did by herself before basically Jeff and I were involved in her case, and she did a very good job of it. The court denied her requests.
Why?
Well, because it has to be based upon new evidence. And one of the things that the statute allows, though, if in fact there is, and there's very a narrow basis is which to within which to appeal a denial of the 440 motion, which would be based upon new evidence. The statute now allows by right an appeal for the DNA. And so we did that. We appealed for the DNA. And then the Westchester County District Attorney's Office finally agreed to allow us to do the DNA testing. So we're in the process of doing the DNA testing as we speak. But that's not the only thing that we're looking at in terms of trying to then get a new 440 motion based upon new evidence. And so we're looking into that the gun and the rifling issue and getting new experts to testify that is in fact junk science that was testified to at the both trials.
What's your time frame about going back into court?
Well, first of all, we're waiting for this DNA evidence, and we want to see.
How long does that take?
It shouldn't take long, except the district attorney. I think within 2 or 3 months we'll have some type of analysis done. The DNA. District Attorney's Office doesn't work that efficiently in getting this DNA to the to our experts that were mutually agreed upon. So we're looking at some other things also. It said, David, a couple of things that I wanted to bring out in terms of why I was involved or why I thought that this was such a good case for me to get involved in, and was certain things that were not presented in our documentary that was just aired a couple of weeks ago. In any event, one of the things was Carolyn passed the lie detector test. Paul Solomon. At the time of the murder.
Just a couple just days after the crime. A
couple days after. Carolyn passed it. Paul Solomon failed it. And they made some excuse as to why he failed it. There was a 911 call from Betty Jean while she was being murdered. And there were, at that time, at this 911 operator, it wasn't recorded. Okay, so because they didn't have the capacity to record that. A district attorney went down and spoke to the 911 operator shortly after the phone call, and he took notes, and he asked this woman, what did this victim say? And she told the DA, the victim told me, he's killing me. And he wrote that down. He is killing me.
Let me ask it.
But that was then explained, and she claimed, I couldn't tell if it was he or she, but see how, the turning and the intentionality. And another aspect of this case also, which ties into the silencer just is important because there was this retired detective and investigator, Vincent Parco, right? And he had his own legal trouble. He also testified against Carolyn, getting immunity, and he's claiming, I sold her the gun. And I had somebody else make a silencer, for me, and gave it to her. Now, since then, he's recently was arrested and went to prison because he was what was that with the witness that
he fabricated a a charge against somebody that he was investigating. So he set someone up, and it's exactly what, you know, this type of behavior that happened in Carolyn's case. And he went to prison for it.
Think that any of this, all this evidence, I mean, him going to prison for setting someone up, I mean, the Dr. Rowe fraud, you know, the junk science. I mean, honestly speaking, any one of those things by themselves is enough to overturn the conviction, much less cumulatively. And that's before we even get the DNA test results. You know, and we're also looking at, you know, testing the bullets also. So we're in the process of trying to, you know, overturn every single rock, okay, in order to conclusively, you know, prove Carolyn's innocence.
All right, the political part of me or the conspiratorial part of me is asking, why is the county resisting? And then, Jeff, I think you won a lawsuit. Are they afraid that Carolyn might, if proven innocent, that they're going to, it's going to cost the county money? Is that a factor? Or am I being naive?
No, I believe that was a factor right up until we have the new DA in office, Rocha, Mimi Rocha.
In Westchester.
So on the eve of when oral arguments were going to be made the next day, you know, by Dennis and his firm, you know, where they were arguing against the DNA. So on the eve of that, you know, I had reached out to her and said, look, you know, I supported you as a candidate. You ran on a justice reform plank that included you committing not to fight efforts at getting DNA testing. You're contradicting yourself here. And so on the eve of that, she relented and said, okay, we're going to agree to the testing. So I don't believe that there's a financial consideration now with her. I think that clearly was at play before under Westchester DA's, you know, DeFiore and Pirro, without a doubt.
All of these innocent project cases, there's just one in the paper recently of a man who sued. That DAs run for re-election and looking, they can look bad with these things.
You can, but here's the thing, is that you can also look good. You can be the hero. You know, look, we're about the truth. We allowed the testing to come. We never think about the money aspect of it. We just want to get at the truth and, you know, are people guilty or are they innocent? And that's what it really should be about.
Let me turn back to Carolyn. You're listening to all of this. You've been out for 3 years. Have you been able to assume a life that gives you some joy or gratification, or are you so preoccupied with determining your innocence for the rest of the world? Or just, I mean, you could just go about, you know, you're on parole, you're relatively free, you could have all of that. Why pursue it?
Oh, well, I mean, I've been pursuing my innocence since day one. I mean, I've proclaimed my innocence, so I'll never stop doing that. I mean, that's just who I am. That's just the principle.
But have you been able to have a life of fulfillment, of joy, of living in New York City? Or is it singularly directed at proving your innocence?
No. I definitely have been able to enjoy myself, even though there's, you know, a pandemic going on. But I've definitely been able to enjoy myself in the city.
You lost 27 years. Was coming out an adjustment, guilt or innocent? Was coming from prison life to the streets tough?
That was a huge adjustment. It's still a huge adjustment. Even just trying to, like with social media or just with technology, with cell phones or computers and everything. I mean, things have changed so much. And, of course, we did not have access to any of that while we were in prison.
And you had a lot of health issues while you were incarcerated.
Right. Well, right toward the end. Right toward the end, I knew that something was the matter. So, yes, I ended up having a massive brain tumor that had been growing for anywhere from, like, 20 to 40 years. But they said, so it was massive.
But
so.
Did the State Department of Correction give you was your medical care acceptable or substantial or?
Well, once we got a new medical director, Dr. John McGurdy, who was wonderful, and once we got a new superintendent, Amy Lamana, and once they were in place, everything was wonderful.
And how is your health now?
Well, I'm having a lot of complications. I've had 5 brain surgeries. I mean, I've had more brain surgeries since I've been out of prison as well. But I see a lot of doctors. I do a lot of physical therapy. I'm still having procedures done. But, you know, fingers crossed, hopefully it will, stabilize.
You know, David, I just want to mention, you know, while Carolyn has been, you know, home on parole, which is obviously much better than being incarcerated, and it is a taste of freedom, nonetheless, in many significant ways, she's not fully free. I mean, for example, she could be returned to prison at any point, you know, should there be a parole violation or an alleged parole violation. Carolyn has wanted to, you know, travel to some places, meet up with family. And so you have to get permission from the parole officer, which, I know there's been at least several times when she's been denied permission. And then, you know, who wants to have a record? Who wants to have a record? Don't you want, you know, she would want to clear her name. So my only point is, yeah, while she has established her life somewhat, there still are nonetheless significant restrictions.
And the stigma.
And the stigma,
you,
for sure.
I've heard you speak, and you said that even though
I was exonerated,
people still deal with you as a formerly incarcerated person.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. I mean, I've experienced a small percentage of people questioning my innocence. I mean, although the actual perpetrator being arrested and convicted eliminates most of that, it doesn't completely cut it off. But then the more common thing, which you and I have discussed on any number of occasions, the stigma. Yeah, you are in prison for 16 years wrongfully. Yes. But you were there for 16 years. You're in prison. So how much of that rubbed off on you? Was it safe to be alone someplace with you? So, yes, it has been a significant factor when it comes to personal relationships.
Well, that's what I was going to ask.
No
Carolyn.
Question about it.
And both you, Jeff, both and Carolyn, in terms of relationships, when you come out of prison, we were discussing this the other night at the Castle, and that was people, when they come out, parole says get a job, you have to get housing. But the most difficult thing is undoing the prison experience, and relationships are a part of it, because trust, and certainly in the case of both Jeff and Carolyn, trust has to be an enormous factor, because you've been deceived by the system. I mean, you were probably kids that saluted the flag and did all of that, and America the Beautiful, and betrayed by the system. I mean, I can't think of another word that identifies the emotional
David, content. David, here's the irony also that I see with regard to many of my clients who are wrongfully convicted. Carolyn goes to the parole board, and she says, I'm innocent. I'm wrongly convicted. The parole board wants to hear, I did it, and I'm sorry about it. And I would assume that Carolyn spent quite a few years in jail because she maintained her innocence.
The parole board is across the country. I call it an elephant's graveyard for retired prosecutors and sheriffs. Mm-hmm. In fact, people who maintain their innocence are punished. But worse than that, well, not worse than that, but equal to that, is people done 30, 40 years, and they're hit for 2 years because of the nature of the crime. And as one man said to me, they hit me 11 times because of the nature of the crime, and on the 12th time, they let me go. He said the crime hadn't changed, but the parole board is doing what the judge initially did. They're making the judgment when, in fact, the parole board should be determining whether they are ready to go out into the community after this whole horrible experience in prison.
So we see all the time, you know, clients that maintain their innocence, that they get more time and they're punished for it.
So just quickly adding to that, you know, that happened to me. You know, I maintained my innocence at the parole board rather than taking responsibility and expressing remorse. And I got denied parole. Just like similarly, you know, they reference nature of the crime. You know, even while at the same time saying, yeah, you have a great educational record, you got a good disciplinary record. So, you know, I've experienced that, you know, and that certainly was a factor in, you know, in terms of Carolyn's parole board appearance. And, you know, the foundation wrote a letter in behalf of her, several of them, urging them not to hold her innocence assertions against her. And that's another thing, and I'll end with this, but a commonality on wrongful conviction cases is that when the wrongfully convicted makes a parole board appearance, they typically stand on their innocence. And, you know, if you were guilty, why would you do that? The gig is up. You got caught. You got arrested. You lost the trial. You lost all of the appeals. And now everything is about, well, you've completed your sentence minimum. Why would you engage in any conduct? Why would you falsely maintain innocence, which could lead to your further incarceration when you've already done the sentence minimum? Only a fool would do that.
Carolyn, how many boards did you go to?
It was my second board that released me. So the first board didn't.
Well, let me ask an audience, a listening audience of activists and concerned people, which is what I like to identify the BAI listening audience. What should people do? Can they do anything? Is there anything that a concerned citizen should do in Carolyn's case?
Well, we can use all the support that we can get.
Certainly when we go to the court. Yeah. Well, look, they can contact the Westchester DA's office. You know, they've agreed to DNA testing. They have not agreed to testing of the bullet item. So certainly expressing that they want the DA to allow, you know, the shell casings to be tested as part of getting to at the truth. You know, that's certainly another aspect of it. When we do go to court, you know, we need people to pack the court. That's certainly...
remind them.
Yeah, we definitely want to remind them. Carolyn, do you want to add anything in terms of public tactics that people can...
Well, I was going to say in terms of... I agree with what you're saying, Jeff, if they can contact the district attorney. I mean, this case was completely circumstantial. They found fingerprints at the crime scene and fingerprints in blood spatter on the stereo glass. So, like, whoever the killer was, like, their fingerprint is there in the blood. And the fingerprints don't match me. So maybe there's a way to test the fingerprints now. It's been over 30 years. You know, maybe there's something with that. There seems to be so much new testing that could be done with so much of the evidence. So that's what I'm hoping, that the conviction
review unit. Yeah. So there are a number of pieces of legislation right now which would address wrongful convictions generally, not specifically Carolyn's case, but generally. You have the Challenging Wrongful Convictions Act. So right now, if somebody is filing a 440 motion, you don't have a right to counsel. The state does not provide you with an attorney. Carolyn got lucky that, you know, her case came to the foundation's attention, you know, and that, you know, Dennis has jumped on the case pro bono. Many people don't have representation. So the Challenging Wrongful Convictions Act would provide attorneys. Another anomaly in the law is that if somebody has pled guilty, you know, if they get evidence afterwards that they're innocent and they file a 440, their attorneys are not allowed to argue innocence. So that's another crazy thing. You would have to argue that your lawyer did an adequate investigation. So that's certainly a bill that's floating around now, you know, that people could contact their elected officials for. And lastly, we do have, the foundation does have like a Patreon page, which is for people who are willing to be recurring monthly donors. I mean, look, if politicians of either party can raise tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars by what they refer to as small dollar donations, why not do that for a justice reform organization? I mean, while we're working on Carolyn's case and 10 others, we have another 7 cases that are approved but are just waiting. You don't have the capacity or the bandwidth to move them. So,
thank you, Jeff.
Yeah, they can. Yeah, I have a website, www.deskovic.org. That's D-E-S-K.
Spell your list.
Yeah, D-E-S-K-O-V-I-C, .org. And they can email me there through there. There's a web portal.
Three phone calls. We'll just say, will you spell that name again?
I'll say it one more time. D-E-S-K-O-V-I-C.
And I have it, so in case you call. Jeff, thank you so much. Dennis Kelly, thank you. Carolyn, what are you going to do for the rest of the day? How do you spend your day now? You're going to go shopping?
I think I'm going to get some lunch.
All right, then that's a good end. Thank you all. Thank you, Exodus House, for letting us do this tape in their beautiful studios.
Yes.
Thank you for having us, David.
Yeah, thanks for having us, David, as well. Thank you.
Jenny Burton, that song was for you, Carolyn, and for all the women that I've met at Fortune and who are now in Bedford who might be listening and back on Rikers Island for the hope for the future and hope that you get your life back. You know, Kathy, I conducted that interview taped at Exodus House, but I heard it through for the first time and listening to it, I was in tears for Carolyn. When you're doing an interview, you're so concerned about the questions being appropriate that you put your emotional content on the side. But listening to it and listening to Jeff Deskovic and knowing his case, I'm overwhelmed. And the fact that people go to prison is such a horrendous experience. My first visit to Rikers Island was in 1966 as a theater person. And as I looked around, I said, this is an exercise in futility. Whatever people are here for, they won't be better off as a result of this. They're coming back to us. And my life has been enriched by people like Jeff Deskovic and Carolyn Wormus, who have taught me so much and sensitized me. And I hope this interview helps enlighten people. My computer is being filled with emails. I see one is from Paris, from Gary. I'm in Paris. I'm in Paris. It's a beautiful day. It's 3:30 in the afternoon. And what am I doing? I'm listening to an incredible interview. Isn't that something? Well, let us hope. I certainly will keep you posted about the trial and as things move along. Can we change the subject? Donald Trump referred to Putin's invasion of Ukraine as an act of genius. I wonder what he thinks now that as a result of this, Finland is joining NATO, which is strengthening resistance to Putin at his border, which means that NATO will have weapons at the border. It's not, as when I was listening to one of the interviews on this station, it certainly doesn't enhance the possibility of peace, but it doesn't strengthen the notion of Putin being a genius. He has consolidated opposition, and that if Finland and Sweden both join NATO, that means right in the upper part of, northern part of Europe, NATO is well established. If you just tuned in, after this cathartic interview, emotional interview with Carolyn Wamis and Jeff Deskovic and Dennis Kelly, to tell you that we're listener-sponsored WBAI, that we get you to the theater if you support us. And I want to remind you that earlier we announced that we have tickets for next week for Romeo and Bernadette, the musical that so many of you have gone to see in the last 2 weeks, sending me email after email about how thrilled you were by it. I'm seeing it finally tomorrow. It opens on Monday, a new off-Broadway musical. Rumors circulating already that it's the kind of musical that will go from off-Broadway to Broadway. We have tickets for Wednesday matinee, Wednesday night at 7, and Thursday night at 7, $50 to BAI for two tickets. It's at Theater 555 on West 42nd Street. Alice Childress's play Wedding Band at the Polanski Shakespeare Center got a rave review in the Times this week. We have tickets for that all this week, Tuesday through Sunday night, and matinees Saturday and Sunday. Americano, the musical I saw last weekend, a really robust celebration of a man who was a dreamer, and a musical had been written around him. It's called Americano. It's at the New World Stages. We have tickets for that Monday through Saturday night, and matinees Saturday and Sunday. And we have tickets for the Joyce Theater opening of a new show on Tuesday. So email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. Give your phone number and you'll get a call over the weekend, making arrangements for you to support us and for you to share in on New York's cultural diversity. Time to get back to living our lives, is it not? Talking about cultural diversity, I was singing the lyrics of that old Black Magic, and I think Johnny Mercer's lyrics are so profound in this. And somebody said, it was a Sinatra hit record. And I said, no, Billy Daniels. Billy Daniels made the big hit of the old Black Magic. And that's what I want to share with you right now. Billy Daniels, that old Black Magic.
What song? I'm sorry.
Billy Daniels and that old Black Magic.
It's all over the world. You know it, so here it is. That old Black Magic.
That old Black Magic has me in its spell. That old Black Magic that you weave so well. I see fingers running down my spine. Same old witchcraft when those eyes meet mine. Same old tingle that I feel inside. Then the elevator starts to ride. Down, down I go. All around I go. Like a leaf caught in the tide. I should stay away, but what can I do? I hear that name, and I'm aflame. Aflame with such a burning desire. Oh, that kiss, 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 can't put out the fire. Say you, the lover that I've been waiting for, the mate that fate had me created for. And every time, yeah, I treat mine, baby, down, down I go. All around I go in the spin. How I love the spin that I'm in under that old black magic collar. I should stay away, but what can I do? I hear that name, and I'm a flame with such a burning desire. Around that kiss, 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 can't put out the fire. Say you, the lover that I've been waiting for, the mate that fate had me created for. The spin, we, how I love the spin that I've been under that old black magic collar. Under that old black magic collar.
Sing the song, man, sing the song.
Under that
old. Just how much of this you really think we can
stand? Under that old black magic
collar. Well, let's put out the lights and call the law.
Under that old black magic collar.
Somebody come get him! Wait!
Under that old black magic
cloak. Just think of Johnny Mercer's lyric: "You're the mate that fate had me created for." It's not just the rhyme scheme; it's the insight and the passion in that lyric, the mate that fate had me created for. From the Arts Corner at the theater, two movies that I can recommend that I saw this past week. Firebird, it's at the Angelica, and it may still be at Lincoln Plaza. It's an English movie. I'm an emotional sucker for movies with stories of thwarted love. Romeo and Juliet, the Zeffirelli's Virgin, the Natalie Wood, Warren Beatty song, Splendor in the Grass, Broadback Mountain, where the social pressures thwart love. And a very unusual one is Firebird. It's about a Russian soldier who eventually became an actor who fell in love with an officer in the Russian army, and they had a sexual relationship until the officer married a young woman who was the young soldier's best friend. And it just got to me because it's all about people being denied the love of the people that they care about because of societal pressures. It's Romeo and Juliet all over. And then I saw an unlikely picture called Operation Mincemeat. It's at the Quads. And Colin Firth is in it. And it's a spy movie, but it's based on a real case. This complicated act, which forced Hitler to move his troops from Sicily to Greece, which enabled the Allies to invade Sicily and begin to solve the war. It's a fascinating movie. I didn't understand all those spy movies. I don't understand everything that's happening, but I was intrigued. And it's called Operation Mincemeat, and it's at the Quads on 13th Street. Firebird is at the Angelica. You may Google and find out where else it is. At the theater, this week, I saw two Tony-nominated musicals, Billy Crystal's Mr. Saturday Night, followed by Paradise Square, starkly different experiences and both worthy of honors being bestowed on them. One of the great joys of live theater is to be witness to the wide range of shows revealing artistic expression. Billy Crystal is the epitome of classic comedy, and Paradise Square invites us to a near operatic exploration of New York City at another time. It was as if some massive human remote control challenged me to a tour of life's mysteries and pageantry, all done to music. It's the theater. Let's start with Billy Crystal. After more than 50 years of entertaining us, he remains adorable. I can't think of another word better to describe him. He's adorable. Mr. Saturday Night at the Nederlander Theater is a tuneful updating of his 1992 movie, places him front and center as an old-time comic who needs to make us laugh. And that he does with his shtick, a gleam in his eye, and adoration for his audience. He has surrounded himself with a cast of pros, starting with David Paymer playing his brother and Randy Graff as his wife, and the team of Jason Robert Brown. Music and Amanda Green's lyrics have provided an upbeat score, while John Rondo has staged the musical with imagination and efficiency, giving Billy Crystal the spotlight. His rich humor has achieved the status of American folklore, and Saturday Night is an opportunity for audiences to absorb that treasure. Now, Paradise Square over at the Ethel Barrymore Theater on 47th Street is a voluptuous new musical cavalcade with a degree of majesty in its presentation. This is a compelling tale reminding of New York City's 19th century past, which is at once noble and shameful. Set in Five Points, a lower Manhattan district, Paradise Square has an operatic score as it recalls the past and painfully links it to the present. Joaquin Calocango, as a bar owner named Melly, serves up a towering performance. Her establishment caters to a collection of lost and some found souls, including recent Irish immigrants and up from the South, former slaves. Nellie's joint is energized by robust men and women whose lively dances are a celebration of their past and their hopes for the future. All of this is as their lives are being shaped by a civil war which is tearing America apart. In many ways, Paradise Square is traditional musical theater. It has a huge cast whose vocal achievements rival the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Jason Howard's sweeping score is impressive, as are the lyrics of Nathan Tyson and Masi Asari. Moises Kaufman's muscular direction pays close attention to the societal maelstrom that surrounds the revelers in the tavern, and Bill T. Jones's choreographic skills are evident as the gifted artists dance, sing, and provide emotional energy. Paradise Square has talent and purpose, which is a daunting partnership. And I have time for a book review. I reach an indescribable pleasure in novels set in 19th century England. Perhaps it's a holdover from my youth when Charles Dickens mesmerized me when I was introduced to Monmouth tomes. And Dickens brought me into that world. I can picture the horse-drawn carriages on Cobblestone Street, and there's always the new books that I'm reading, there's always a murder just around the corner. One of the best current storytellers capturing the ethos and time of all that is paradoxically an American, Will Thomas, who lives in Oklahoma. How and why, that's a mystery to me, but his latest tale, Fierce Poison, published by Minotaur, is a prime example. You went to the world of Detective Cyrus Barkley and his protege partner, Thomas Llewellyn, and you can put the agonies of the 21st century on the back burner. Because in Fierce Poison, Roland Fitzhugh, a new member of Parliament, arrives at the Barker Llewellyn office seeking help, but literally dies at their feet, a victim of poisoning. And as the saga begins and 19th century London comes to life, several folks are poisoned and the domino effect has Scotland Yard embattled. Author Thomas puts the reader right there in the middle of the mayhem along with the former Prime Minister Gladstone. You can breathe in the fog and feel the sounds of the time. Pure pleasure, the poison and all. And so that's the Arts Corner. The Tonys were nominated this week, but the big news was Jesse Williams' penis. He's the actor in one of the actors in Take Me Out. Is that it? A very good play, a revival of a of an excellent play that I saw, and there's a scene in it where the baseball players are all in the shower and they turn around one by one and there are exposed their anatomy, their lower anatomy. Now, I grew up in high school gyms, college dorms, army barracks, and have been a member of the Y for 50 years. So the sight of seeing a penis is not exactly startling to me. Obviously, somebody got a picture. You're not allowed to take pictures, and it went viral. I suspect the press agent did it. The box office is going crazy. Everybody wants a front row seat. And Jesse Williams' anatomy has gotten more, not since Sharon Stone's vaginal cavity was threatened to be exposed in that movie, has there been so much excitement about the private parts of a star on stage or screen. I don't understand it. Haven't people seen those things before? They're just, I know that it, when I saw the play and you saw the naked men, they said, yeah, that's how I see it. That's what I remember. The same with the women on screen that you, when you, the nude breasts. Well, yeah, that's it. What a confused people we are, aren't we? All right. That's the Arts Corner from the BAI perspective. Let's go out with Pavarotti and Frank Sinatra singing this song. And I want to thank you all for staying with me today and sharing Carolyn Wamus's unique experience. Let us hope. Frank Luciano, let's hear from you.
And now the end is near, and so I face that final curtain. My friend, I'll make it clear, I'll state my case, of which I am certain. I've lived a life that's full. I traveled each and every highway and more, much more. I did it my way.
Regrets I had a few, but then again, too few to mention.
I did what I had to do. I saw it through without exemption. I planned each charted course,
each careful step along the byway, and more,
much, much more. I did it. I did it my way.
Yeah.
David Amram, you're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 on your FM dial, and keep on listening.
for WBAI in New York. I'm Linda Perry, thanking new BAI buddies. Tracy Washington from Somerset, New Jersey. She's a new buddy and hopes WBAI continues and informs the people. Her favorite show is one we just relaunched, Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly. It's broadcast on Fridays at 5 p.m.
Welcome to Black Agenda Radio, where we provide news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective.
Daniel from Lodi, New Jersey, thank you for becoming a new buddy. He says he likes all BAI shows. Nathaniel from Philly is a new buddy, and so is another buddy from the Village. Gregory from Massapequa says thank you to WBAI. His favorite show is What's Happening with Ralph Pointer and Betty Davis.
Get set. Ralph Pointer, What's Happening?
Good evening, my sisters and brothers and sisters. We do have an interesting program for you, as we promised.
David Somerville from Harlem is a large WBAI buddy contributor. His favorite show is Living for the City with Michael G. Haskins. He also likes many of our programs. He lists them, The Gary Null Show.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We begin with the latest on health and healing. This comes from the National Institutes of Health, National Institute on Aging. Lower the risk of dementia in people who are...
Baby,
Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall.
Yes, here on WBAI 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. There is so much going on in the world, and it's great to know that WBAI is here for us.
David also likes Black Agenda Radio and Milton Alamadi and Colin Benjamin's Black Star News.
Greetings, greetings, sisters and brothers. Welcome to your favorite Pan-Africa news show.
From the Streets with Bob Law.
Let's look a little closer at the music that in a real sense could be called the soundtrack for the 20th century. It's going to be an interesting conversation. So join me this sunny spring Saturday in the city. This is 99.5 WBAI. I'm Bob Law.
Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look at the origins of the war in Ukraine and the role that the United States played in bringing that war about.
We speak Mind Flight with Imhotep Gary Bird.
Well, good evening. Pass the word. We are back with you flying high on a Sunday night. It's Imhotep Gary Bird's Radio GBE, Mind Flight, your gateway to the black experience. As you know, Mind Flight is all about the local, national, international stops and the stops of mind, body, and spirit that take us soul traveling wherever the winds of change take
us. Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. Vantage Point with the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels. Paul Fisher's What's the Frequency, Kenneth? Peter Beauchamp's All Mixed Up.
What a beautiful morning. Turn on the radio and let's have some music.
Democracy Now!, which is broadcast weekday mornings at 8 a.m. right after WBAI's new morning program. What's